Gustav Touton Beauregard was down at Petersburg, meanwhile, with just a few thousand Confederate defenders in the works. And he began to send messages to Lee. There are a lot of Federals in my front. There are a huge number of Federals in my front. Please send reinforcements. We're having a crisis here. Please reinforce me. This traffic is going, these messages north to Lee from Beauregard. Lee thought Beauregard was confused. He wasn't, of course. But the Federal commanders on the scene couldn't seem to orchestrate an effective set of assaults to carry these lightly manned works at Petersburg. Both the commanders were veterans, William F. Smith, Baldy Smith, on the one hand, and Winfield Scott Hancock on the other. As a rule, they were quite capable officers, and Hancock, better than just capable. He had moments of great success during the war. But these two men, who had about a 9-to-1 advantage over Beauregard in the early stage of the action at Petersburg, failed to push into the city. They mounted ineffective assaults on June 15th through the 18th. Lee finally realized what was going on and rushed troops from the Army of Northern Virginia southward to Petersburg. By the end of the day on the 18th, the opportunity for a major Federal victory had passed. The Federals had lost another 11,000 men. Confederates about half as many, and each side was now busy constructing what would become the most intricate and impressive set of trenches put together during the war, a system that anticipated what would be done on the Western Front in Europe during World War I on a much vaster scale in World War I. Well, why had these assaults failed, these Federal assaults? I think several factors. First, poor communication and coordination on the Union side. More important than that was a reluctance on the part of Federal soldiers to attack well-entrenched Confederate defenders. Many of their officers were reluctant as well. Cold Harbor was still fresh in their memory. Whatever Grant had thought about the willingness of his men to make these kinds of attacks when he wrote to Halleck just before Cold Harbor, by this stage of the war, Union veterans had had enough of these kinds of attacks. There was one point on June 18 when a veteran unit refused to make an attack and yelled out to a Green regiment that was forming to make an assault. The Green regiment is getting ready to go in. The veterans hollered out, "Lie down, you damn fools. You can't take them works. Don't do this." The big regiment went in. It was a huge regiment, one of a number of regiments that had been heavy artillery units manning the fortifications around Washington. As Grant needed troops during the Overland Campaign, these heavy artillery units were converted into infantry units and sent to the Army. One after another of these big Green units was chewed up in the Overland Campaign. This one that made the attack on the 18th lost 632 men out of 850 who made the assault. The truth was, the Army of the Potomac had been bled almost to death since May 5th. Lee and Grant had opposed each other for just about a month now, and Grant's casualties were averaging more than 2,000 a day. Lee averaging 1,000 a day. Put another way, the armies were averaging a battle of First Manassas every day for 30 days. That's the degree to which the war has changed since July of 1861. The Battle of Manassas was a huge event when it occurred in July of 61. These armies are averaging one battle like that every day. Was a terrible butcher's bill for both sides and absolutely unprecedented in the war, even in a war with Shiloh and Chickamauga and the 7 days. There was nothing to prepare either side for this. General Warren, commander of the Union 5th Corps, wrote bitterly, "For 30 days it has been one funeral procession past me, and it has been too much." As I said before, there's no respite of the kind that you used to have in between battles. None of those periods for maneuver or refitting. The campaign of 1864 was sustained fighting on a grand scale, and it had taken an enormous toll. Grant's corps of veteran troops had been expended in the hard fighting, and the replacements simply weren't up to the original standard. There had been more than 64,000 Northern casualties. That's about how many men Lee started the campaign with. But beyond that, another 18,000 Union troops left the Army because their 3-year enlistments ran out right at this time. They'd enlisted for 3 years back in the early days of the war, and now they got out of the Army. This left Grant and Meade with a largely untested Army of the Potomac. Not only the raw number of men gone, but the loss of veteran officers was crucial as well. That component of leadership, all the way from the company level to the corps level, had taken a great toll. Now, Lee had suffered 30,000 casualties, every bit as onerous as the federal casualties, because he was working with such a smaller pool of manpower. It was a little bit less of a problem for Lee because, for the most part, he was on the defensive and was behind works, but nonetheless, horrible attrition in his army as well, among officers and among men. Neither one of the armies, you often read that Grant's army wasn't the same after this Overland campaign, but neither was the Army of Northern Virginia. The Overland campaign, to a significant extent, destroyed the old Army of Northern Virginia and the old Army of the Potomac. Grant's strategy of attacking Lee and trying to defeat him in the field had been in part dictated, as we saw earlier, by Northern desires for real victories. They thought, finally, our man Grant is going to go down there and he's going to whip Lee. Finally, we have a man who will do that. But the result of this campaign had, in fact, been a lowering of Northern morale. It's the endless bad news made its way north from Virginia. Grant hadn't done what the people expected, and because expectations had been so high, the Northern people had been in for a tremendous letdown. And when you add to that letdown in Virginia the fact that Sherman had not captured Atlanta yet, when you add to that the fiasco of the Red River campaign, of Butler's ridiculous position between the James and Appomattox Rivers, Sigel's defeat in the valley, when you add all of those things together, you had a potent mixture that sent Northern civilian morale plummeting to its lowest point of the entire war in July and into August 1864. A siege at Petersburg would necessarily be long, even if it was almost certain to succeed, and Atlanta might hold out for a long time as well. Never before in the war had things looked so dark for the Union from the point of view of many people behind the lines in the North, not even during the depressing winter of 1862-63. Many people in the North, including many who fervently wanted to fight through to victory, many of those people even believed that it might not be possible to suppress the rebellion. Perhaps the rebels are going to win, many people in the North thought. Well, we'll leave the military arena now with Grant and Lee digging in at Petersburg and with Sherman and John Bell Hood doing the same in Atlanta. Our attention now will shift to the home fronts and we'll begin with an evaluation of what was going on behind the lines in the Confederacy.